in a way, I'm seeing kind of this, the rise of the micro specialist. You asked me who a vintage Rolex expert is. Okay, a couple of people come to mind. But then when you kind of drill in deeper into what reference, more people come into mind. When I started in this industry, you were a watch specialist, an expert over 500 years of horology. That generalist idea is kind of gone by the wayside.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulvern, and this is Hodinkee Radio. This is it, the big 9-9. It's pretty crazy to think that a little over 2 years ago we launched the show and that we're almost that big three-digit milestone. We're going to have something special for you next week, don't worry about that, but that doesn't mean we don't need to bring the heat this week too. Up first, we've got our own Danny Milton talking to golfer Rory McIlroy, a multi-time PGA champion and a diehard watch guy. This is going to be a video that's actually going to run on Hodinkee.com later this week, but we wanted to give you a little taste early of their conversation. I'm not going to ruin too much. You'll get to hear a little bit of the conversation today, and then be sure to check back later this week to see the full video. It's awesome. It's a really special conversation. I'm super happy we can give you a taste here. And after that, we've got my conversation with John Reardon, who's a veteran of the auction world. He's one of the leading experts on all things Patek Philippe. He's written multiple books on the subject. And he's the founder of Collectability.com, which is a new online platform for learning about and buying vintage Patek watches. John was actually my gateway into the watch world back in 2012. We'll give you the full story on that. But suffice it to say, I think we can say that this whole podcast is actually kind of John's fault. So I can't believe it took us so long to invite him on the show, but I think it was worth the wait. Without further ado, let's do this. This week's episode is brought to you by Zenith. Stay tuned later in the show for my conversation with Zenith CEO Julian Tornare. For more, visit zenithwatches.com.
All right, I am Danny Milton, editor at Hodinkee. I am joined by four-time major champion, reigning FedEx Cup champion, and reigning player of the year, Rory McIlroy. Thanks for joining us, Rory. Welcome in.
Thank you. Thanks for the nice introduction.
For sure. You know, when you win all the awards, you got to at least, you know, appreciate them. How's everything going with you right now in these sort of crazy, crazy times?
All good. Happy to be back out and playing, even though the environment that we're competing in is obviously a little different. It's been a crazy and really interesting year for everyone. But just thankful and grateful that, you know, things are still not normal, but, you know, we're able to at least return to work and do what we love doing. So, all in all, everything is actually okay.
That's interesting. How would you describe the difference between playing sort of in the age of COVID as opposed to having fans at least following you and potentially really huge crowds following you on the course?
Yeah, it's different. You know, it's in ways the start of weeks is actually a little bit easier. Like practice days and stuff, I feel like I'm spending more time at the golf course. You're not really expending as much energy physically or mentally in terms of bumping into people, signing autographs, all that stuff. So, but then once you get into the tournament, that's when it starts to feel different, you know, especially on the weekend. You know, you're in contention. You usually get all these feelings, you know, final group or last few groups going off on a Saturday or a Sunday, and you just don't have that. And I think that's what's been really interesting. And for me personally, it's been sort of hard to focus on the course at times. Usually with the crowds and the atmosphere, you know, it's easy for you to focus on what you're doing, but then, you know, if all you're hearing are the birds chirping in the trees and, you know, your mind can wander a little bit. So that's probably been the biggest challenge for me on the course, is just trying to keep my focus and concentration levels where they need to be. all the way around. And it's been good. I mean, the first four tournaments back, I've realized that and I've learned from it. This is the way it's going to be going forward. So, it's nice to play those few events and get a feel for how some of these bigger tournaments coming up are going to feel.
That's interesting, because I always think about having, especially if I'm trying to imagine what it would feel like for you when there are large crowds, having to focus in and ignore the crowd. But it sounds like not having them there actually makes the focus a little bit harder when you think it would be the opposite.
I'm so used to playing in front of people, right? So whenever I play at home with friends or whatever, that's when I do find it the hardest to concentrate. So that's probably why I'm finding it this way as well. It's, since I was, 15, 16, all I've done is play golf in front of people. And now I don't do that. So it's, it's not the norm for me, So you're, if anything, you're sort of taken out of your comfort zone a little bit whenever there aren't people there. And sure. That's sort of strange to say, but it's, it's just like, it's a little bit different. Everyone's got to deal with it. And as I said, it's something we're just going to have to get used to, for the next few months anyway.
Definitely. I think some of at least the Hodinkee readers would be interested to know, and I would too. I've heard a little bit about your sort of origin story, but just like walk us through kind of, I know you had, you grew up playing golf, but tell us a little bit about that. What was it like sort of growing up in Northern Ireland, coming up, and sort of when you knew, at what point did you sort of know, and I feel like it might've been at a young age, like this is going to be it. This is the thing I'm going to do.
Yeah, it was from a young age. I mean, I think, I was quite sporty growing up, so I played quite a few sports, soccer, tennis, a little bit of rugby at one stage. But golf was always the thing that I excelled at and the thing that I was the best at. From a young age, I knew that I had a talent for it. But I didn't really, I enjoyed it. I loved what I did. I loved the fact that I was better than everyone else at it. But I didn't really know that it was a thing I was going to do. I would maybe say something, as a innocent and naive kid that I was, going to be a professional golfer and win majors and all that stuff. But I didn't really know that until I was probably 15 or 16. That I knew that I had the capability of turning pro. And at the start, it was just about trying to make a living from the game, right? That was, you turn pro and that was sort of what it was about. And then once you get on tour and you realize that you can go further than that, that's when I started to readjust my goals and be like, well, it isn't just about making a living now. It's about winning tournaments. It's about winning majors. It's about trying to be the best. So, it's been... golf has been a part of my life the whole way through, but I would say since sort of my mid-teens is when I knew it's what I wanted to do.
You and I are about the same age, so would you say Tiger Woods was sort of that icon for you coming up, that one person you sort of watched and followed as a kid?
Yeah,
on the tour?
Yeah, for sure. I think anyone in our age group, I remember even before Tiger turned pro, I remember watching him win the three US amateurs in a row. And then 97, he wins the Masters, his first major. And then from there, so Tiger was a huge hero of mine growing up. And I had a poster of him on my bedroom wall. I knew all his records and achievements and wanted the latest and greatest Nike stuff all the time. Him and anything he used or anything he did, that's what I tried to do. So Tiger has been a huge influence on my life, especially in as it a youngster growing up and trying to emulate what he was doing. But then also since turning pro and getting to know him a little bit, he's been a pretty good friend on the tour too. So that's been pretty cool. When your idols can become your rivals, and that's sort of what's happened.
Definitely. So I have to bring you back to 2011, because at the US Open, that's actually the course in my hometown. So Congressional.
Oh, okay. So, Bethesda.
Bethesda. Exactly. Yeah. So I was there. I wasn't there on Sunday, but I was there on Thursday and Friday watching. And you were different back then. You had the longer hair, totally different look. So
yeah.
Take us back to long hair Rory. you know, running away with the US Open. I mean, that must have been just a crazy feeling. I mean, you're 21 years old, just running away with it.
Yeah, different. It honestly seems like a lifetime ago. And it is. It's going to be a decade ago next year. I think back to that time, and I think back to the, you know, that tournament and winning by 8 shots and winning, you know, and just sort of the ease of it all, and not the ease, like I feel like I look back then and there was a lot less thought about everything that I was doing. I was very raw. It was all talent. It was all just relying on that, where I feel as if I've got more experience and I know a little bit more about myself and about my game, and I sort of probably manage myself a little bit better. But it was just, you know, some weeks you just show up and you're on, and you try to ride that wave of momentum, and that's what I did that week. Because it's not as if it sort of came out of nowhere. I mean, I was playing okay in 2011. It wasn't as if I, you know, had great results, but it was just, you know, you turn up some weeks and you just feel good about a place and where you're at. And I love Congressional. I loved it the first time I played it. I thought it was a course that was right up my alley and suited my style of play. But I never expected to go out and do what I did that week. I'd love to, you know, obviously it's been a while since I've won a major, but and I'd take winning them by one instead of 8 shots, but it's a pretty cool feeling. It seems like a lifetime ago. And honestly, it's a little bit of a blur. I remember some parts of the week, but I definitely need to watch it back on like on YouTube or something to remember everything that happened.
Yeah, you definitely made what was considered to be a pretty hard course, at least for people who played it, look pretty easy, which was amazing, because it was one of those things for sure.
Yeah, I think all the players were cursing me because we went to the Olympic Club the next week the next year in San Francisco, and the USGA made sure to set it up a little bit more difficult.
So I want to like talk about watches a little bit. This is Hodinkee after all. So
sure, exactly.
How did you even get into watches in the first place? And do you find there's a similar sort of connection between, you know, enthusiasm about something, passion for something, collecting, for example?
I've always been into watches, even when I was a teenager. So any money that I had, I would save. Or I remember my first big paycheck after a good finish on the European tour. You know, I went straight to a jewelry store and bought myself a watch I wanted for a while. So it's always been somewhat of a passion of mine. And as the years have went on, you start to learn more, and then being exposed to different companies and the craftsmanship and the brands and what they stand for and how that sort of aligns with you, I think that's all really, really cool. So it's been a big thing. And I think as a guy, it's sort of, there's not, you know, I don't really wear bracelets, or, I mean, I wear a wedding ring, but can't really change that much, or necklaces or whatever else. So
for sure,
as an accessory, it's the one thing that you can change and sort of, you know, sort of mix it up a little bit. So that's why I've always enjoyed it. And I've always, you know, I follow you guys on Instagram, and I'm looking at watches all the time. And obviously I'm a brand ambassador for Omega, and I love Omega watches, and I have a bunch, and I've started to sort of collect them too. But it's not as if I don't look at other cool things that are happening in the watch world either. So
for sure. And for those of us who didn't come up the way that you did, what's it like for a young kid who turns pro and you get to, you know, you get to be a brand ambassador and you get access to a lot of cool watches. And especially for somebody like you, who you said you already were very much into watches to begin with, what's it like to sort of all of a sudden have that kind of great access and get to, you know, be exposed to really cool pieces and things like that?
It is. It's really, really cool. And I get that I'm in a privileged position. You know, a lot of these you know, I still like there's been, you know, a few Omega pieces, even though I'm a brand ambassador, that I will pay for myself because I want them. I mean, when I won the FedEx Cup last year, I bought myself the Omega Tourbillon because that's something that I wanted for a while, and I wanted to treat myself whenever I did something that I felt merited getting something like that. So, but it is, it's cool to be exposed. And I think as well, it's cool to just learn how some of these pieces are made and the detail that goes into them and how long some of, you know, how long some of these things take to be created. And, you know, like the Tourbillon, it's one person working on this thing for right. such a long time. And I think it's that, and that's when you know, we talk about wine as well and getting exposed to that. And I obviously enjoy drinking it and I enjoy the taste and all of that stuff. But I also enjoy hearing the stories about what went into making this wine. And okay, the weather this year actually wasn't so good, so this is what we had to do. We had to, you know, the harvest was early or it was late, or we had to do this or that, or, you know, so all of that is, so there's all the stories behind these things. And it just so happens that watches and wine are very collectible at the minute, and they're very sought after.
For sure. And I did a little diving into your Instagram too, and saw that you're a pretty big Speedy Tuesday fan. So you wear the Speedmaster pretty often. Is that a watch that you sort of tend to fall back to a lot of the time?
I do. I've always loved the look of a chronograph. So it's something that I do wear quite a lot. Omega actually made me this Speedmaster for my 30th birthday, that they released a limited run of. And this is one that is pretty special to me because there's not many around. And yeah, I wear this one quite a lot. I actually had to get a new wedding ring because my other wedding ring's platinum. But I got like a gold and titanium one to sort of match this watch because I wear it so much.
That's great. Yeah, that's the Speedmaster 57, right? That was for your birthday. It's a really cool watch. It's
I wear that one quite a bit. It's again, it's nice to know that you've got something on your wrist that not a lot of other people have, I guess.
For sure. And on that note, you also got a hand in designing a watch or developing a watch, the Ultralight.
Yeah,
you know,
the Ultralight. Yeah.
What is that process like? How do you get into the development process of a watch? What's the connection of that watch specifically to sport? I don't know if it's golf specifically, or, you know, just sort of, you know, what was that like?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be golf specifically. I think it's light enough that you could play, you know, basically any sport with the Ultralight on. So I guess the guys at Omega came to me and said, look, we're trying to develop a watch that, you know, you can wear on the course if you want to and play with it and sort of make it really sporty, but still have the integrity of what Omega is all about. So we're trying to make a new movement. We're trying to create it with materials that will withstand the shock of hitting a golf ball or a tennis ball or whatever you're doing. So, I mean, I feel like they really thought outside of the box to create the Ultralight, and I feel proud that I had some little hand in it. I obviously got a couple of prototypes at the start, and you know, I give them my feedback, but at the end of the day, I'm not a watchmaker. So, you know, they take my feedback and they tweak it a little bit. And, you know, they came out with the final product that everyone saw it, in Switzerland last year. And, it was a really cool process to be a part of. I'm grateful that they listened to the feedback and they, you know, valued my input. And yeah, it's a cool watch, and I wear it a bunch. And you know, if I'm out and about and I know that I'm, you know, getting my hands dirty, or if I'm doing something with some activity, you know, the Ultralight's what I go to. So it's cool to be a part of something like that. And yeah, it's a very cool watch.
It is really cool. And I guess, like, as an artist, you get to sort of be honest about the work. So you're happy with how it turned out, I'm guessing. So on a scale of cool to super cool, where does it sort of fall in that sliding scale for you?
Yeah, it's cool. I'd say the one thing that, like, obviously it's, you know, with brands, you're trying to still keep it in line with all of the other things that you create, right? So it's, you know, and there's little details on it, like the lines on the face, which, you know, it could be like the grooves of a golf club. But the one thing that I would love to see, just because the movement inside is so cool, if they could create like a skeleton version where you could actually see what, because it's an incredible, you know, piece of engineering basically. So maybe one day we'll see, but it is still a very cool watch.
And I like the pop out crown. So the push button crown is really a cool thing too.
And it is. And especially, you know, if I'm playing golf and I wear it on my right hand, my right wrist, just because it just feels a little, with the glove on and stuff, sometimes it just gets caught. But if you do wear it on your left hand, it definitely makes such a difference being able to just push that crown in. For sure.
So do you, I don't think I've seen it, but what's your position on golfing while wearing a watch, just for those out there who do or don't?
I mean, I think it has to be the right watch that you're wearing to play golf with a watch on, because, you know, you can't just go out with any watch and whack a golf ball around, because the shock of that is going to, you know, ruin the mechanism inside.
For sure.
So it has to be the right watch that you wear. And that's why there was so much thought and work put into the ultralight, to make sure that, you know, no matter what you're doing activity wise, you know, the movement was going to be durable and intact. So, but I'm all for, you know, wearing a watch, wearing watches while you're, you know, doing whatever sort of activity, and, you know, the lighter it can be and the less intrusive it is, the better.
So I saw also that you have a Speedmaster, I think from 89. So it was a fellow 1989er.
Yeah.
The birth year thing. Is that something, I guess it's pretty special for you. I think it's a really cool thing to have if you have an opportunity to get a watch you love from your birth year, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. You know, that was another really nice gift that the Omega, my Omega family, I call them, you know, sort of presented me. And yeah, it's really cool. I wore that watch on my wedding day, which was really cool.
That's great.
So it's got some great memories for me. I don't wear it too often. I sort of try to keep it, you know, I bring it out on special occasions. But it's really cool to have a watch that was created on your birth year. You know, they had to go into the archives and sort of try to dig one out for me, but they found one, which is really nice.
So the PGA is coming up, you know, it's going to be in San Francisco at Harding Park, originally scheduled in May and pushed to August. Does it feel a little bit, at least, you know, the circumstances aren't great, but generally speaking, the PGA would be in August before the schedule changed, I think a couple years ago. So is it a little bit more familiar just sort of having this tournament this time of year, you know, at least, you know, for you?
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm just happy that a PGA championship's getting played at all.
Right.
But in a way, it's nice that it's in August, especially San Francisco, because there could have been a couple of cold days in May. San Francisco is just, obviously the climate there can be, you know, it can be really nice, or it can be gloomy and cold. And, you know, hopefully, you know, we've got a better chance of some decent weather in August. So I'm happy to be playing. I'm happy to be heading west in a couple of weeks' time, and I'm getting ready for it.
As a two-time PGA champion, does this particular major hold a special place for you?
It does, in a way. I've gotten to know quite a few people over the years there, and it holds something special. The traditions are cool. Usually they have a champions dinner every year, and the winner of the previous year hosts it, and that's something that's really cool. I've had some really cool times at that. Obviously this year they can't do it, which is unfortunate, but it's a cool trophy. It's cool to have my name on it a couple times, and hopefully, you know, get my name on it a third time here in a little bit.
So every year, do you train a little bit differently? Do you change something about your game, try to tweak something? This being the first major of this season, is there something that you're looking to bring to that, you know, you haven't, let's say, just even last year, even though you had an amazing season?
Yeah, I think because of, you know, the whole COVID situation, you know, the majors fall pretty much right in the middle of the season, and you're playing up to them. And I think what this year will allow, not just me, but maybe a few of the other guys, is maybe to ramp up, you know, to sort of ramp up the intensity for the bigger tournaments. You know, there's so many golf tournaments that we play nowadays. You know, say we play 25 events, you know, four of those events are majors, but you know, they sort of just come in the middle of the season, and you know, there's maybe not as much time to prepare for them. So I think with the PGA coming up in August, US Open in September, and then the Masters in November, it allows us time to maybe just ramp up the intensity a little bit and really make those the focus of this year. And that's really been my thing coming out of the lockdown. It's like, okay, obviously there's all these other events that are important, but you know, the three things that I was really thinking of is PGA, US Open, Masters, and trying to get my game in good shape for August, September, August and September especially. And then we have a little break before Augusta. So yeah, I think if anything, it's going to allow me and the other guys a chance to really hone in on getting ready for the major championships.
Is it easy to sort of block out the fact that schedule wise, everything is so different that a US Open is in September, that you're not in Augusta in April? You know, is that a weird thing? Is it going to be playing that course when I'm assuming all the flowers won't be in bloom the way they normally would be in April? Not that that makes a huge difference for you. But is there any sort of mental difference there?
I don't know. I mean, Augusta have a way of doing things. I wouldn't be surprised if the flowers were blooming in November.
That's true.
There was a time in March or April when it didn't look like any of these things would be played. So to be able to just play them, even under extraordinary circumstances where there mightn't be fans and, you know, they're not in the same month of the year that they usually are, it doesn't make a difference. I think everyone's just glad that they're being played, and you know, at the end of the day, someone has to win them. So you got to show up and be ready.
For sure. Now I got to ask before we go, for any given tournament, you know, whether it's press day, let's say you win the tournament and you're holding up the trophy, how many watches are you bringing to a tournament? And is there a choice each day you're wearing a different watch, or do you bring one watch for a tournament? You know, how does that selection process go for you?
I bring multiple.
Okay.
Mostly to do with what I'm wearing. So I'll probably bring four. Yeah, usually four. I've got like a little travel case, and it fits four. So yeah, I'll usually bring four. This one usually comes with me everywhere. You know, the ultralight usually goes with me everywhere. And then I'll try to do like another, like I've got a black and gold Planet Ocean that I wear quite a lot. And then usually, because it seems like all the rage now is like steel with a blue face, seems mm-hmm. like these are just popping up everywhere. So I usually travel with one of those. So I've got like a Seamaster GMT steel with a blue face that I travel with quite a bit too.
That's awesome. I think I've seen you bring the Moonwatch with you on at least to some tournaments as well.
Yeah, the Moonwatch. The Moonwatch sometimes. I've got a couple of those. But sure. I switch it up. But you know, right now this one, the Ultralight, the Planet Ocean, and then the GMT are the four that I'm going with.
That's a lot of fun. I think that at least everybody on Hodinkee will have some fun watch spotting, trying to see what you got on.
Exactly.
When it comes time for the tournament. Well, listen, Roy, really thanks for joining us today, taking the time out of your day to talk to us a little bit about golf, about watches, about life in these sort of crazy times that we're all trying to figure out in our own, you know, unique ways. So we really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah. And best of luck at the PGA, and we're all going to be watching.
Thank you.
And now a word from this week's sponsor. I was excited to sit down with Zenith CEO Julian Tornare to talk about how the manufacturer has been dealing with the last few pretty crazy months. Julian turned out to be wearing the new Chronomaster Revival Manufacturer Edition, and we talked about what this watch means to the history of the brand, as well as how they've transitioned to a world that's gone mostly digital. It sounds like Zenith's been busier than ever, and Julian gives us a little bit of a peek into what might be coming over the next few weeks and months. Let's give it a listen. It's good to see you, Julian. How are things in Switzerland?
They're okay. They're good. They're good. You know, things are getting step by step back to normal. So we are happy because it was a tough period of time. But now it's better every day.
That's great to hear. I mean, the world's obviously been a little bit crazy lately. I think that's fair to say. But how have you guys been adapting to a new normal at Zenith?
For sure. I mean, you know, one of the things I'm convinced is that during crisis, this is when you need to be even more active. Zenith has been named by quite a few people from the industry as one of the brands that has been the most active during this period. And I'm happy and proud of my team because they did a great job. And I'm convinced that we have been gaining market share over the last few months. I've never been so much in touch with end clients, with the different channels, through email, through video, through presentation. But I have to say, I learned a lot about the Zenith client during the few months.
I wonder, on a personal note, what has been the watch that you've been wearing the most over these last couple months, you know, through the isolation, through quarantine, all of this? Which watch has been your sort of go-to?
I'll be very honest with you. During this period, it was not an easy period for anyone. And we all had a lot of negativity around us. And we were surrounded by negative news. And you switch on TV, you listen to the radio. I'm a very positive person. And I needed to have something on my wrist bring a lot of positivity. And I've been wearing that watch, actually, the manufacturer edition. It's this famous blue dial, three shades of blue dial. But for me, this watch represents very much the strategy of Zenith, saying to connect the past to the future and to continue to make new things, as these people who made that watch in the 80s did. So it's been a watch full of emotion for me, and I have to say I needed positive energy during these few months. Yeah,
I think it's interesting that the El Primero is ultimately a movement, but over the years Zenith has sort of created a design language around that movement. How would you describe what makes, outside of the movement itself, what makes an El Primero an El Primero?
As you said, the El Primero is a movement. And at Zenith, for many years, we have been more known for our movement than for a watch or for the brand. And that's good. People often ask me, is it a strength or a weakness? I always say, guys, it's a strength. It's amazing to have a movement like the El Primero. It's probably the most well-known movement. The importance for us now is to bring iconic watches. And that's why we're doing the Defy and the Defy 21 and the different things that are also equipped with an El Primero. I mean, the work we've done is rebalancing, you know, the influence of the El Primero, which again, I want to keep as a key asset of the brand, but it should not put the brand behind the movement. You know, that's super important.
Yeah, I mean, even just within the El Primero family this year, I mean, we've seen the Chronomaster Revival Shadow, we've seen the Revival Manufacturer Edition. Outside of that, we've seen the Defy 21 Ultraviolet. I wonder, amongst this year's new releases, is there one that stands out to you as sort of core and most exciting, maybe?
I will definitely pick the Shadow, because the story behind the Shadow is quite amazing. And, you know, in August 2019, we launched the re-edition of the A384. Immediately became a bestseller. That particular shape, which is very Zenith, by the way, had never been relaunched since the original one in its original size. It was done in a larger case where, in my opinion, we lost a bit the elegance of the watch, but now relaunching it in 37 was a big thing. So launching the Shadow for me was, how do we combine an iconic shape owned by Zenith with today? We use microblast titanium to go as close as possible to this particular watch that we found in our museum as well, which was black PVD from 71. So I say, this is fantastic. You know, Zenith is about authenticity. And once again, we're going to launch a watch that's linked to something true from our past, from our DNA. In periods of times like today, everything is shaken up. And I think people tend to run away a bit from the bling bling, the show off, and they want to stick to real stories, real value, substance, content. And these are elements that are very important in times of crisis. So I believe it came at the right moment. Yeah.
So I'm sure you can't tell us too much right now, but what are you most looking forward to about the rest of 2020 at Zenith?
There is something in particular, and as you guessed, I mean, I'm not going to be able to tell you the whole thing, but I'm going to tell you that in October, we launch a piece, will be made in a certain material and in a certain way that's only been done in the very high end, with very high end watch price, as you can imagine. I'm talking 150, 200K, 300K. And for the first time, Zenit will be the one coming with this kind of watch, done in a beautiful, elegant way, in a totally different price segment. I cannot tell you more, but I haven't told anyone anything. So this is the most I can say, but wait for October. There will be a watch. I mean, for production constraint, they won't be more than, I would say, 100 or 120 per year. So it's going to be very exclusive, but it's one of the coolest watch. And I did wear it as a test. I was a lucky tester during confinement. So I've been wearing it at home and I loved it so much. So I think it's going to be something so special. You will love it for sure.
Thank you so much for talking to us. It's always great to get some insight from you into to the industry and into Zenith. And it sounds like there's quite an exciting year ahead.
I'm looking forward to the next time we can meet in real. Thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you to Julian for taking the time to talk. And if you want to learn more, visit zenithwatches.com. All right, let's get back to the show. Up next, we have my conversation with Collectability's John Reardon. Hey, John, good to see you.
Hey, Stephen, how are things?
Good, things are good. I'm coming to you live from Minneapolis, Minnesota. It's the first time I've left New York in, I guess, like 6 months. It's a little weird to not be in the city, but I see that you are in your office as well.
Yes, this is only my second day back in Collectability HQ. The last few months have been spent at home, dutifully quarantining with my family. And it's strange just not being surrounded by people, my immediate family in particular.
Yeah, I'm sure. And also, like, you've been in businesses for a long time that, like, you're, like, a huge part of your job is interfacing with people. Like, you're not sitting in an office kind of, like, doing your own thing all day. You're mixing it up with folks.
Yeah, historically, my life has been defined by travel and people and face-to-face, and of course, watches. And over the last few months, it's been me, my family, and of course, watches. Which we'll
I was going to say, I think there's still some pretty good watches coming in and out. Yeah.
So no complaints. It's just we're all like learning to walk again. It's a whole new reality globally.
Yeah, that's wild. Well, I mean, we'll do the whole backstory of you and your career, but I wanted to start off actually giving people a little bit of insight into how we met. You might be the first person, like, properly in the watch industry who I met. I was freelancing a story for Business Week about the Graves Fullerton auction. I was still living in Chicago. Mm-hmm. It was 2012, spring of 2012, and I called you to interview you about the sale, and you told me, like, if you've never been to a watch auction, you've got to come see this. It's going to be awesome. Turned out it happened 2 days after I moved to the East Coast. I wasn't even living in New York yet. I was living in New Haven with my now wife for a couple weeks before my apartment was ready, and trained in for the day and saw the auction, was totally bit by the bug. Ended up through our friend Eric Wind meeting Ben, and that's how I ended up at Hodinkee. So this is all your fault, is what I'm trying to say.
You could blame me or thank me later.
I think we'll do both, honestly. Yeah. I think it's both. But
I remember your phone call. I was sitting. It was at Sotheby's, and I was next to Darren Schnipper, and we had that chat. And I just remember you asking the right questions. You're genuinely inquisitive about what this whole watch thing was all about. And I was so excited that you took me up on the offer to show up at the auction, because everyone is always afraid to even show up at an auction. And you showed up, you learned about it, you caught the bug, and hopefully you'll be doing this for many, many more years.
I hope so. Yeah, exactly. I'm in way too deep to get out. Yeah. It was funny looking back. I mean, like, I remember getting off the subway, and, like, I had no idea where Sotheby's was, and just, like, the walk to Sotheby's, I was like, where am I going? Like, what have I signed up for here? And then, You know, at the time, I didn't know who any of these people were. But in hindsight, I mean, you know, I was sitting right behind William Massena. I was, you know, James Lambden was across the room. Michael Safdie was there, like kind of all these people who have, in a funny way, become like a very big part of my life over the last, you know, I guess, better part of a decade. Mm-hmm. We're all there. It was a funny little day.
That was an extraordinary sale. And I wish we can go back in time and buy some of those watches, because
you and me both.
Wow.
Yeah. What was it like putting that sale together? I mean, you already had a pretty good amount of auction experience, which we'll get into. But that sale, I think, probably marked kind of a new kind of moment for you, right?
It was nothing like the Time Museum sales. In 1999, I was spoiled being part of the masterpieces from the Time Museum part. Yeah, one.
That's true.
Including the sale of the Henry Graves Super Complication. So, I mean, that set the benchmark very high. I remember being rather disappointed of how few people were in the room for the Graves Fullerton sale.
Hmm.
Being
interesting.
I expected it would have had a little more buzz and excitement, which I think in recent years we've seen rekindled in the auction world. But it was, you remember, it was a pretty sparse room.
It wasn't packed. Yeah.
And the prices that things were going for, I wasn't so excited. I mean, they were quite reasonable. Many mutual friends of yours and mine bought some great watches at incredibly low prices in retrospect. But being part of the preparation of that sale was, from an emotional point of view, was quite sad. Pete Fullerton passed away, which was tragic and unexpected. That's Henry Graves' grandson, and I grew to be friends with him, and that was hard. And each of those pieces, I remember him just speaking in detail about. They were his babies. They were his passion, and the way he connected to his grandfather, as he referred to Mr. Graves, was magical. So when the gavel goes down at an auction, it's a closed chapter. But then a new story begins, and you see these watches resurfacing and recirculating with collectors, and it's fun to track. But you always go back to the person who originally owned them and cherished them, and he was addicted to watches. I mean, he was ahead of his time. Well, he kind of, I guess it was in his DNA from Mr. Graves.
True.
He just wanted to talk about watches, discuss their preservation, compare and contrast and criticize. Always had criticisms of how Patek Philippe can do things better. And it's the same conversations we see online today were happening 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah, that's wild. I mean, and you mentioned that he kind of like had watches in his DNA. And in a funny way, you did too. I mean, you grew up in Bristol, Connecticut, right next to the American Watch and Clock Museum, right?
Yes, it was extraordinary. I mean, I think about, my kids are old enough now, they're getting braces. So
okay.
I'm discovering the world of orthodontics for a second time in my life. And when I was a child, I went to see an orthodontist called Dr. Warner, whose office was in his home, which happened to be the Sessions mansion of Sessions Clock Company. And it was one of those beautiful homes I've ever seen, 100-year-old mega mansion. And Dr. Warner had his office in this massive residential building. And I just, I think back to the magic of seeing clocks on the wall and the whole idea of just growing up in a community that was centered around these names. In Connecticut, it was all like Seth Thomas, Ingram, Sessions. These people built that part of Connecticut, and everywhere I went, I was surrounded by it. So I was very fortunate to have a pathway to the American Clock and Watch Museum, which I was as a teenager when I first went there, and that set me on this crazy path that I'm still on.
And so when you went to the museum, what was kind of the next step for you in terms of your enthusiasm? Like what were the first clocks and watches you were excited about, and how did you sort of like get into this?
And when I first went, it was I was essentially dared by my brother-in-law. Well, currently my brother-in-law at that point in time, he's dating my sister. He was and is a watch collector, and he encouraged me to go to this museum, which is close to my house, and I literally laughed at him and said, what kind of loser would go to a watch and clock museum? And
the two kind of losers having this conversation, yes, right now. That's exactly.
So I was, you know, I was a smug teenager, but I went, and my eyes just opened up when I went into this world. It was mechanical beauty, history, science, art, all combined in one. And for me, local history too, whether when you see a Sessions and then you were just in the home of where the owner of Sessions was, it just connects all the dots. And then I just became obsessed. And thanks to the curator of the time, Stuart Mitchell, and the former curator, Dana Blackwell, these two gentlemen, they taught me about watches and clocks, and it was my introduction to an amazing world. I'll never forget those first few years at the museum were just extraordinary, because it's like people today discovering watches online for the first time. They get obsessed, they go down rabbit holes, and they learn. And you could do that from the comfort of your own home today in our quarantine inspired world. But back in the 90s, the only way to do it is through people and in learning. And I was able to disassemble, clean and overhaul dozens, if not hundreds of clocks during that experience.
Wow.
And that was fun. And I'll never forget that those early years in the clock world, at least.
Yeah, I think that's something people may not know about you, is like you're not just a watch enthusiast, but like you also have a technical background. Like you have done restoration work. Like you're really a technician as much as a scholar.
Yes, not at the highest level for sure, I can disassemble and put back together a clock. And even at my height, I was able to do a 3-train movement, and I was very proud of that when I was able to get one of these back together, running and functioning for years. I still collect clocks. I still do a little work for fun with my personal collection. But watches are another story, and that's why I have so much respect for watchmakers. I just don't have the patience, the stability with my hands. I can't do the same work with clocks as I can with watches. It's just, it's next level. And I'm just in awe of what people can do, but I'm able to watch what they do and understand what they're doing and respect what they're doing, because I can't do it. And that's admiration and awe.
And then when did you kind of look at this and say like, okay, this can maybe be my career, like this can be my life's work, and I can like really set out on this path long-term and make this my life?
In high school, I guess I'll call it moonlighting. When I had a job, I was doing three different jobs: working at the museum, which was volunteer work, working at a funeral home, and also working as a lifeguard. It was the three most bizarre things ever.
That's a trio right there. That's no joke.
Come to think of it, the funeral home that I worked at was the home of the founder of Welch clocks. So I never even thought of that. So it's like everywhere around.
That's wild.
It was clock horologically related. So in short, I started my free time cleaning and overhauling clocks for like friends and family. All of a sudden, you're getting $100 a year and $100 a year, and then I started to expand it. I just found my original business card from when I was 15 years old.
That's awesome.
And it said John Reardon. I think at that point said specialist in clocks, and I didn't even know the word horology. And word got out there that I could overhaul your great great grandfather's clocks, and all of a sudden I was charging $300-$350 per overhaul. And at that point in time, that was a ton of money for me. And I was obsessed. I was doing so many different jobs as much as I could with all the spare time I could put together. So that's when I knew it would be not necessarily a career, but it'd be a hobby for the rest of my life.
And then you made a jump into the auction world later in the late 90s, right? Like 97-ish?
Yep, it was 1997, right after finishing school. I accepted an internship thanks to an introduction, Dana Blackwell from the museum, to Darren Knipper at Sotheby's. And Darren kindly took me in, and wow, that was a crazy time, because I never thought I'd live in New York City. And I very quickly learned that living in New York City wasn't inexpensive. And I was literally being paid nothing for the first 3 months. It was just an internship at Sotheby's. So I remember put my resume together. I went to Wempe. I've never shared this publicly. This one's for you. This one's for you, Rudy. I went to Wempe, and I just literally was begging for a job. And they were like, no, we're not interested. So then I was like, all right, let's try Torno. I went to Torno. Actually, did get up to a second interview, and that was a possibility. I remember many of you might know Andrew Turin, and I almost went to Torno early on in my career, and I'd probably still be there selling watches if that happened. But they at the end of the day, that didn't work out. And then the last person, the last place I went, almost got a job at Bloomingdale's selling watches.
And interesting.
That also didn't work out. So I went back to Sotheby's, and I was like, hey, I'm willing to work for anything. I was like, I tested the market, and I can't get $8 an hour, but I really love vintage watches. And amazingly, Darren gave me the opportunity, and I was able to get a job as an administrator in Sotheby's watch department. And that was one of the most difficult jobs I've ever had. And you know, the administrators in the watch departments at all the houses have one of the most difficult jobs in the world. It's you're the gatekeeper to all of the problems.
Yeah, exactly.
You're the fixer. And that's the way you learn the business. You're dealing with the buyers, you're dealing with the sellers, you're dealing with all of the intricacies of the bureaucracy. And that was that's where I cut my teeth at first.
Mm. And then you mentioned the Time Museum sales. Can we talk about that for a little bit? I think those are something that maybe today's watch collectors may not even know a lot about. I think they like were just early enough that folks who like really came into watches through the internet might not even know what these sales were. So can you give us a little background on this?
Oh, it's true. So Seth Atwood was one of the greatest collectors of all time. So like after the era of Graves and Packard, after JB Champion, starting in the 1960s is the era of Seth Atwood. And he was from Rockford, Illinois, an industrialist. If I recall, he made his money like parts from like vacuums and stuff, like some various things. I have to fact check that. But I was able to meet Seth during my time at Sotheby's and was in complete awe. He had his own hotel, or we'll call it a motel, in Rockford, Illinois. And in the basement of this motel was the Time Museum, which was without a doubt the greatest horological collection assembled in the 20th century. There's no competition. It wasn't just Patek Philippe. Of course, he had the best. He had the super complication. But with Breguet, he had a Sympatique, which is now at the Patek Philippe Museum. With going back into early sundials, he had the best of the best in every category of any horological strain. He really invested heavily ahead of the time. And I asked him once, I was like, what's it all about? Like, why do you collect? And he was one of the few people that gives a real honest answer. He's since passed, but I think he gave a very frank answer. He said, because I love the hunt. He was in it for the hunt. He loved searching. He loved the intrigue. He loved fighting. He loved competing. That's what it was all about. So for him to let these pieces go was not emotional in the same way it might be for a collector that really would never let go of a piece. He put it together. It was time to let it go. And there could be books written about that whole situation, but no one expected these pieces to show up at auction. And that sale, December, I remember the date, December 2nd, 1999, the room was packed. It was the who's who of horology of the 20th century. And for me to have that small part of it was a dream come true. And that really launched my career, because you were introduced firsthand to the greatest collectors in the world. And you were here working side by side with the greatest pieces on earth. And I remember for like 6 months, you have those watches, those clocks and the sundials, just like literally like 2 feet away from you. It was the ultimate school.
Do you remember the first time you got to hold the Super Complication?
I do. I had to go to Rockford, Illinois to pick it up. And I remember going through, in pre September 11th era, like flying with an object like that. I had to bring it back to New York. It was extraordinary. And going through security with a bomb-proof box containing the Super Complication led to many questions. And I remember making some new friends with the security guards at O'Hare at the time. So,
can imagine trying to explain to a security guard at O'Hare that there's like a priceless, complicated pocket watch in this box. Must have been quite a trip.
And frankly, it ticks like a bomb. It could look like a bomb.
you can't open it.
And the box that we had was, it was suspicious at best. And because I remember having the conversation where like, what happens if a plane goes down? We need to make sure the watch is safe. I mean, we weren't even thinking about ourselves. We're thinking about the watch existing after us, which is a really horrible thought to have.
Yeah.
So we did go to great lengths to find something that could survive pretty much anything. I bet that box is still sitting on a shelf at Sotheby's.
That's wild. And then that was in 99. And do you remember kind of after the sale or, you know, in the midst of the sale? I mean, the Super Complication is definitely the watch everybody talks about. But are there other highlights from that sale that you still think about?
Oh, for me, the tortoiseshell Sympatique made for the Duke d'Orléans. At that point of time, and everyone makes fun of my personal email, which starts out with Breguet. They're like, why do you have a Breguet email? I was obsessed with Breguet. And to see the mind of a genius with that piece in front of you was beautiful. And just taking the pocket watch and putting it on top of the clock. And for those of you who don't know what a Sympatique is, what it does is the clock reaches up and sets the watch exactly so that they work together. And that's why it's called the Sympatique. And Breguet himself made very few of these. I can't remember. I think it was less than a dozen. And this particular piece in tortoiseshell was just magic to me. Mm-hmm. And yes, I had that sitting right next to my desk for a long time. Because Patek Philippe bought it, no secret, because you can see it at the museum today. And that's why, I mean, it's fun. When you walk around different museums or see these important collections around the world, you recall and remember where these pieces surfaced and were before. And it's fun. I think because in Stacey Perman's book, A Grand Complication, she reveals the buyer of the Henry Graves Super Complication as Sheikh Saud Haldani. Mm. And I can go back to that time in 1999 when he came in and I showed him the watch. He literally looked at it and said, I'll buy it. That was it. Patek Philippe had no chance of buying that watch back. They were the underbidder, but the Sheikh was going to buy it no matter what. And the Sheikh has sadly passed away. And I remember a few years back, I had lunch with him, and he described museums to me in a way I've never thought of before. He said, and specifically regarding the Patek Philippe Museum, he said, the Patek Philippe Museum is the graveyard of all Patek Philippes. And I was really hurt by that. I was like, how could he say that? And I asked him, like, what are you saying? And he explained it to me. Because a collector needs to collect. A collector needs to hunt. It comes back to Seth Atwood. There's always a better watch out there. And you need to keep searching and finding. But once pieces go to a museum, that's it. that's the end of the road. And 99.9% of the time, like I don't believe we'll ever see the museum, the Patek Philippe Museum, selling any watches. Right. So in his mind, the museum is where it stops. And that was very powerful for me to hear that. And of course, I love seeing pieces going to the Patek Philippe Museum, but I do recognize it might be the end of their story of our lifetime, at least.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing, and I want to kind of push on that idea a little bit, and not because I totally disagree with it, but I'm curious to kind of push on it a little bit. I mean, there's a way in which any museum, whether it's a museum, you know, holding paintings or sculptures or watches or scientific instruments or whatever it is, you know, is sort of a collection for everyone, right? Like with a ticket to the museum, you get to participate in that collection. Whereas when a watch goes into a private collection, it's private. Like it's only for that one owner or the people that owner chooses to share with, share his collection or her collection with. I wonder what you think about that. Like, is for a historically important watch like the Super Complication, like where do you think it belongs? Does it belong in the hands of one dedicated, extremely passionate collector who can, you know, take it out once or twice a year and look at it? Or does it belong in a place where thousands and thousands of people can see it and appreciate it every year, even if that means that it's never available again for a private collector?
Wow. This is getting very philosophical for earlier. all right. First of all, when I see a piece go to the Patek Philippe Museum, it's coming home. And to me, it's a very romantic appeal. I love that happens today, that great pieces still go to the museum. Because that place has almost religious significance to me. I mean, that's where they belong. Now, discussing Sheikh Saud's comment, I do understand that. And I could talk from an auction perspective. When you see a piece in the wild and when you see a piece at auction exhibition, you could pick it up with the right specialist. You could open it up. You could see it. You could feel it. You could touch it. If it's a repeater, you could listen to it. You could wind it. And this makes it very much alive in a way to connect. Once it goes to a museum, it's in a way, it's in a coffin. No one's going in that case. No one can touch it. And when I go to the Patek Philippe Museum now, even if I asked, if I begged, even if I had good reason to actually see a piece and hold it in my hand, it's not going to happen. It's just, it's in the case and that's where it stays. So I really look at every auction as kind of an opportunity to see pieces. I'm talking like the best of the best.
Yeah.
For the last time, because you don't know where they're going next, and they could be off the market for generations. So I see both sides of that argument of whether these great pieces belong in museums or great collections. On the other hand, I know great watches that should be in museums that are right now on wrist, and people are probably practically jet skiing wearing these watches, and that's horrifying to me. A collector has the responsibility to care for these pieces properly. And I think most of the time that does occur.
I think there's one collection to me that strikes me as kind of a middle ground between these two things. And that's the buyer collection.
Yes.
Where like it's a private collection, but it's housed in a museum environment. But if you're the right either buyer client or in our case, you know, your journalists, like they will take stuff out.
Take
like
out.
I had the opportunity to put the Everest Explorer on my wrist, and like that to me might be the most incredible thing I've done in this job ever, just like full stop, to be able to put that watch on my wrist. And obviously you can't just walk in and ask to do that, but like in the right circumstances, it's a more maybe living museum. It's a less dead museum. However you want to phrase it, but yeah, it's an interesting thing. It's tough because these watches, one of the amazing things about watches, and one of the things I think you and I both love about watches is the way in which they are little kind of like vessels for history. And that does carry a responsibility, but at the same time, like they're meant to be enjoyed and they were made to be used. And at what point does, you know, wearing, you know, Patek split second from the 30s, become, at what point does it transition from, you know, serving the purpose it was originally made for to risking the history. And that's I think, a fuzzy line. I don't think it's a particularly clear boundary.
I think that's well said. And it's the same with cars.
Yeah, oh, totally. Cars. Yeah.
When you see these, I was at the Henry Ford, well, it was last year, amazing museum, by the way. And and once those cars are like just pulled into a corner, and you don't even know if they can run or not. I can't speak on behalf of the Ford, but they're gone. Now, when you go to like a rally and you see the vintage Ferrari taking a sharp corner, I mean, that's magic. And so there's got to be an answer in between. But these mechanical objects deserve to live on in one shape or form. So.
Totally. I mean, one of the things you said a few minutes ago that I think, you know, we try to hammer home to people all the time, and I'll just say it again, is like, go to auction previews. Like,
yes.
Even if you're not buying, even if you're not bidding, even if you've never registered and you have no plan to register, even if you don't own a watch, like if you're interested in watches, go to auction previews, because you can handle the best of the best. You know, if you're respectful and you show that you're interested and you sort of like do things the right way, you can have a multi-million dollar unique one of one thing from 80 years ago on your wrist and in your hand, and you can have a world expert sit and talk you through it. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like a free masterclass opportunity.
And you just answered one of the most common questions I think I receive, and I'm sure Hodinkee receives, is like, how do I break into the industry? So many young people, they want to say, they love watches. They've read every word that they've seen online, and they want to be part of the industry. And my first answer is always, first, look at the auction catalogs online. It's free. Go to the auction previews, because then you could meet and engage the people and see the community at work. I'm just shocked. There's so many cases where I see people, even that have like high presence on Instagram, saying that they're the biggest experts in the world, yet they're not even part of the community. They've never actually showed up to any auction.
Yeah.
Sometimes they ask, do you need a ticket? And I'm like, wow, you're out there saying you're connected to everyone, but you've never actually gone to Geneva to a watch auction, and you live an hour away. So I think it's just people need to be invited and told that they're more than welcome to show up the auction previews. All the houses will welcome you. And it's such a fun way to learn. And when you walk in, you're going to see people you know, and in passionate conversations, debates. Some of the best drama I've ever seen, where it was just collectors and specialists arguing at preview, because everyone cares so much, as they should, about their opinions. So I can't wait until we could all come together and go to these auctions. I mean, it seems like now a distant history where we could all come together to these exhibitions, but it'll come back together soon enough.
It will. What advice do you have for people going to previews? Like whether it's their first preview or their 100th preview, like, are there two or three things that you think you should always do, questions you should always ask when you're at an auction preview?
Number one is listen. You could learn a lot. I think one way that I've learned, and I'm going back, well, I continue to learn, we all do, is when you have a watch on the table, and all these exhibitions, they always have a table set up where, well, this isn't a pre-COVID world, but where you can sit together and talk about a piece. And those conversations, that dialogue, that debate is where you could really learn. Okay, what's been done to this dial? What's been done to this case? Is the crown original? I mean, this is where it all begins. So number one, go to the previews, listen. And you'll find at the exhibitions, typically these are people that have skin in the game. They're engaged, they're real buyers, they're real purchasers, they're owners. They're not people online just throwing out comments who have never actually held a piece in their hand. These are people that are engaged in a real, real way. So I really just encourage people to go, be part of the community in a human way. And I think one thing I've learned over the last few months is, you know, it's not just about watches, it's about people. And I dearly miss seeing everyone in person. And I think when we can come together, we just can't take that for granted anymore. And I hope that people come to exhibitions to engage in these dialogues. This is what makes it fun for all of us.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I love going, you know, I obviously go to Switzerland quite a bit, as do you. And some trips are more exciting and more fun than others. But the auction seasons in Geneva in November and May, that weekend when all the auctions are happening and all the collectors are around, it's the best. You can't walk. I mean, literally, you can't walk 10 feet in central Geneva without running into someone you know or someone you've heard about or somebody you follow on Instagram. And you just learn so much from all the chatter that happens even outside the previews. Like, I love, you know, on an auction day, going to La Réserve or to the Four Seasons or whatever, the Beau Rivage, and going and just like having a coffee or a drink in the lobby for an hour or two before the sale starts. And just the things you overhear and the people you run into, you find out who's bidding on what, all of this stuff. And like, you can't do that by following the sale online. That just doesn't happen.
And we're so, one thing I've learned over, as I mentioned, over the last few months, I've been active with all the auction houses as a buyer, and in one case as a seller. And for those who might say, hey, I live in the Midwest and I'm unable to go to Geneva, just because of travel restrictions, you name it, you could still be engaged with the community and learn from the watch auctions in a way that's most importantly, it's free. It's enjoyable. And all the catalogs are online today, which is just fantastic. And if there's one thing I learned from the level of engagement I had with the various specialists in my auction experience this last season, is that if you get people early enough, right when the catalog comes out, you can have those long, interesting conversations. Just don't wait until the day before. From my auction career, I could tell you everybody wants to talk the day before the sale. And you literally, as a specialist, as the gatekeeper, you don't have time to talk for an hour or two about an escapement. You just don't, because there's that transactional element. So I always encourage, try to get people in the off season or early on when the catalogs go out, because that's when you're going to learn so much, and people are willing to share information, and it's just it's a lot of fun. But there are auctions, even like look at Jones and Horan in New Hampshire, for example. I love following their auctions, and George and Patty run such a nice show up there, and you could buy something for $500, $50,000, everywhere in between. Heck, even a couple $100. I've had some luck buying some things at auction there. So you don't. It doesn't have to be Phillips, Christie's, Sotheby's. It could be a lot of space in between too.
Hmm. That's a great thing to remember. That's really, really good advice. You know, we could talk, I think, for probably multiple hours about your time at Sotheby's and Christie's and go through all of it. But I want to make sure we get to some other things. So to kind of wrap up the auction portion of this. You know, you talked about how great it is that the catalogs for all the sales are online now. And I think that's 100% true. And we've seen, you know, with the auctions that just happened during COVID, the fact that these sales could take place online and have positive results is amazing. But it's also opened up the auction world to some competitors and some other forces, things like eBay, things like Chrono 24. How have you seen those sorts of platforms kind of reshape the vintage market and the secondary market for watches?
I'm really coming to grips with my own feelings and how would you say, my own way of analyzing what's happening on the market today and how things are changing. I do believe that the auction world, the auction life that we were just describing, that we all knew, is dead. Things will never be the same. It's a classic case of a punctuated change forced upon us from unexpected surprises due to the pandemic. The human element will probably be different moving forward. But it's talking specifically now about the marketplace, the inefficiencies of the traditional watch auctions, which have been exposed over the last 20 years, thanks to digital media. I mean, Hodinkee has been a real driver in telling the real story behind watches that have shown up at auction, both the good and the bad. Lots of great controversy over the years. thank you. And I remember from an auction perspective, you're watching every word Hodinkee put up there, every comment that people wrote, because you're trying to manage the unmanageable of how people's emotional response to an auction might be. I think all of this has shown, this punctuated change has shown that auctions are going to change, because this, the gatekeepers of the perceived walls of getting into an auction and bidding and competing are now falling, or they've fallen completely. The fact that auction houses who very heavily invest in their staff's travel, salaries, huge amounts of money are spent to put on the show. All of a sudden, it doesn't make sense for more of a commodity watch. It makes sense for Paul Newman all day long. It doesn't make sense for a reference 5004. I mean, something that's, we know what it's worth. This is what it's worth yesterday. If the market moves a little, that's fine. This is what it could be worth tomorrow. So all of a sudden, that spread of 25 to 35% that the auction houses are making, I'd say the people have spoken. It's unacceptable. And the word is out there. For the best of the best trophy pieces, yes, auction will continue and we're going to see exciting new records breaking. But for more of the commodity based watches, it's the market has to change, and in that we are seeing it happen right before our own eyes right now. So we'll have to stay tuned and watch this change that's occurring. So in short, the new platforms, well, they're not new anymore. I mean, eBay is certainly not new.
Yeah.
eBay has its pluses and minuses. There are so many fakes on eBay on any given day. It just makes me cringe. Yet, I still sometimes buy something from eBay. You could find some
for sure
really interesting things. But it's let the buyer beware, because it seems to me it's a customer-to-customer market, and there are sharks circling everywhere. Chrono 24, which I've started listing on, I have to say it's been a surprisingly robust platform that I think they police a bit more. I'm still, it's a bit upsetting. You still see fakes on Chrono 24. That I think they're working on it, improving, kind of wiping off the stuff that shouldn't be on there. But there are a lot of great pieces too, and it's a great lead indicator. But you see new companies, Watchfinder, Watchbox, that are really trying to redefine what this will be in the future. What people want at the end of the day is to buy from a credible source. They want to call someone up who knows what they're talking about, will stand behind it, and do the right thing. The auction houses are so big and so bureaucratic right now that often, even if the specialist wants to do the right thing, they might not be allowed to, because they have to go through four different bureaucratic channels to get a yes or a no.
Yeah.
But and this is where I think dealers fit in. This is why I'm a dealer now. you're literally putting your name, your expertise, your knowledge, your connections out there. That's what you're selling at the end of the day. But you're also assuming all of the risk and responsibility of standing behind everything that you sell. And many of the best and most successful dealers out there do this on a daily basis. And they're driven by passion. They're driven by the human connection and trust that they have with their collectors. And in a way, I'm seeing kind of this, the rise of the micro specialist, where not even, okay, if you want to, you ask me who a vintage Rolex expert is. Okay, a couple of people come to mind. But then when you kind of drill in deeper into what reference, more people come into mind of individuals that might know that watch better than anyone else in the world. Like this is only for Eric Koo to answer. Same thing with Patek Philippe. Depending on what you're looking for, I would refer different people to based on different references. There are certain individuals out there that just really know everything about a specific reference. And that's what makes it so much fun. Where the idea of it, when I started in this industry, you were a watch specialist, which, by the way, you're responsible for all watches and all clocks and being an expert over 500 years of horology. And that generalist idea is kind of gone by the wayside.
That's gone.
No, yeah, it's you can't find anyone out there that can talk about a Janvier and also about Loom on a Daytona. They don't exist anymore.
Your specialty, you know, your platform, just so we get this out there, your platform is collectability, and you launched this last year. Mm-hmm. And you're really an expert in, I would say, vintage Patek Philippe. Is that a fair way to characterize that?
Yes. So the vision of collectability is to offer people an education in vintage Patek Philippe, which incredibly hasn't been done in a robust way on any platform around the world. Auctions have done an amazing job traditionally. What Patek Philippe does is incredible. But there's no centralized place to really learn, study, and transact with vintage Patek Philippe. And that's what collectability is all about. I mean, it's no coincidence. It's what I know best. It's what I love. I mean, it's not work for me. This is just such a pleasure to focus on what I'm most interested in. Surprisingly, it's you go down many different rabbit holes. And my company's only now 7 or 8 months old. And I've had so many adventures. I think I knew I worked hard in the past, but I've never worked harder running my own company. It is absolutely 24/7. And I'm not complaining, because it is incredible learning experience, just like the nuts and bolts of running a company. From a watch perspective, that's where I'm having so much fun. I've started... of course, my Instagram collectability LLC continues to grow. I've started a YouTube channel, which right now, as a few minutes ago, a video just came out, which might be a bit controversial, but we'll have a little fun with that.
We'll make sure to link that up in the show notes so that people can go watch it.
That's going to wrestle up a few comments, no doubt. So I think the using these different forms of media to educate, inform, bring awareness, I'm finding people are like, well, I never knew I wanted that. I never knew it existed. And wow, it's not even that expensive. I need to have one of those pieces. And my primary focus is pocket watches and wrist watches from like the golden era, like the 1930s through the 1960s. But I have done a lot with 19th century pocket watches. I don't want to get into the modern market. I think it's very crowded right now, and it is commodity trading. But many collectors want to trade modern Pateks towards vintage. So I do take some modern pieces in stock too, which is incredible. I mean, the fact that I bought a 5711 Line 1A blows my mind. It's just like that's like against the grain of what I want to be doing. But you look transactionally, sometimes people they want to move this, they want to have this, and you end up with watches that are just surprising. So for the modern pieces, I just want to move them out quickly. The vintage pieces where I want to spend my time, focus, and really create a product that doesn't exist today in the world, where someone can walk away with a watch and literally know everything about it.
Yeah. And like you said, I mean, the interesting thing about what you're doing, right, is you're also... you're creating demand, and you're also creating a community of people who understand it, right? Like, it's all good and well for one collector or a collector and a dealer, or two or three collectors, to understand a particular reference. But like, if you really want there to be a market for it and a community of people around it, you need a way for other people to learn about it.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the cool things with what you're doing, is that it's a place that it can be a place to educate yourself. It can be a place to shop. It can be a place to find out more, so that you then know what you want to buy. It's kind of like multifaceted, and people can kind of get out of it what they want, whether they're ultimately purchasing a watch from you or not. I think you're you know, educating the community in a altruistic way, but also like you're making sure that there is a market for these things in the future.
That's true. There are trends in place. Everyone always asks, like, all right, what's next in the watch world? What should I be looking at? And I'm always feeling out people if they're a collector type or investment type, trying to figure out where they're trying to go. And often I give two different answers. If they're investing, I'll say, all right, let's go down this road. No promises. Past performance is no indication of the future. But if you're a collector type, I'm going to take you down a different road. And some people are more technical collectors and some people are more aesthetic collectors. But the same rules apply. I mean, it's really about condition. And that's where I'm spending a lot of time explaining condition, showing condition, and so people understand what they're buying. There's no secret. There's a lot of garbage out there on the market.
Yeah.
There are pieces that you could just cringe just looking at. But if you're new to the market, you might not know what to even ask. And those are the dialogues I'm trying to create. And through the YouTube channel has been a surprise. In that the engagement is very high and people really, they like to see watches, discuss pieces, and the comments that I have offline are as valuable as the ones online. You have really interesting conversations. So
that's awesome.
Stay tuned.
Well, I mean, you kind of preempted me here, but I wanted to finish up. You know, I mentioned it earlier, but like, we could spend hours and hours talking about Sotheby's and Christie's and your time at Patek. I mean, we haven't even talked about that. Is the fact that you worked for a decade? You know, like we've skipped a whole chapter in your career here. We skipped the fact that you've literally written the books, plural, on Patek Philippe. So there's way more than we could possibly cover in our short chat here. But I wanted to get some actionable advice for people. So you mentioned that there are different kinds of collectors and you give different advice to different sorts of collectors. So I'll ask, you know, for let's say maybe the aesthetic collector, the technical collector, and the investing collector, what do you think are the areas that each of those people should be looking at right now? And it doesn't have to be Patek, it can be, but what do you think each of those categories should be paying attention to right now?
And I'm only going to answer these within the world of Patek Philippe. There are, of course, great, a million alternatives at price points that are much lower and in some cases higher. So, but I'll stay within my wheelhouse. For aesthetic opportunities, I mean, I look at Rani Medvani as one of the greatest aesthetic collectors in the world. And he was so far ahead of everyone else. And the way that he looks at these as an art form and the way he presents them on Instagram is unsurpassed. So using that type of mindset, looking at some of the Markowski cases with 990 calibers from the 30s through the 50s, and I see some collectors starting to buy these shaped and formed watches, you know, the famous Hourglass, the Banana, the Marilyn Monroe, they all have great nicknames. These are incredibly good value today. They're very soft on the market, in particular anything that rectangular form watches. So for an aesthetic collector that likes history and likes design, those are quite interesting. For the technical collector, of course the 3417 comes to mind first. I think the whole rise of the amagnetic collecting circles is just at the beginning, as people learn and understand these pieces more, this, yes, Patek Philippe did make tool watches and they functioned and they were brilliant and they're beautiful and they're understated and they're often white metal. And I mean, it has all the right ingredients. So I think I'm seeing some high-end Rolex collectors crossing over into some of the Patek Philippe tool watches, we'll call them. So that's starting to begin. For the investment collector, this is tough because who knows, right? I really look at supply and demand, and condition can help dictate the supply very, very, very quickly. And that's why I quickly conclude pocket watches are one of the best places to buy pieces today. Here's the reason. People aren't refinishing dolls on pocket watches like they have with wristwatches. Sometimes because of the fact they've been sitting in a box for 100 years and they haven't seen the light of day. Yeah. We don't have the problems that we see with wristwatches. The moisture and shock problems that we see with wristwatches all the time don't exist with pocket watches in most cases. you take enamel dial pocket watches. All right, it's pretty simple. They've been cracked or they haven't. It's there, and you could find a restoration quite easily. So finding a beautiful Gondolo pocket watch with no hairline cracks, to me, for under $10,000, even much less, is just a no-brainer to buy. And that's where I think the aesthetic collector, the technical collector, and the investor all come together. And people, they're not just defined as one. It's sometimes a mix, and just try to feel out what they're looking for. Mm. But with the way we see gold prices approaching $2,000 an ounce, that just blows my mind. That I think there are pocket watches in the market selling for under their gold value today. There's that slight disconnect. And then it's looking at platinum prices. I don't understand that, how that could be half of gold right now. We're being an ex paddock guy, seeing platinum at 50% or less than 50% of the value of gold makes no sense to me. But I need someone who's an expert in that circle to help me out.
People, if anybody wants to help out, comment on the story on Hodinkee.com, yes, or hit us up on Instagram, and we'll connect you. We'll find a solution to this.
You can explain why steel is more valuable than gold.
Yeah, that's
platinum, and it's just completely confusing.
Yeah,
and the rules in watch collecting don't apply. I mean, it's all we have to do is talk about the Nautilus, and
right,
it seems like case metal makes no sense.
Yeah,
in terms of value.
So the last thing I want to ask you about is maybe the exact opposite of the Nautilus, which is, you have kind of led a revival of one of the most underappreciated Patek watches. You've kind of become Mr. Ellipse over the last couple of years. What is it about this watch? I mean, I happen to personally like the Ellipse. I know a lot of people who really don't, and most people have very strong feelings one way or the other. What is it that you love so much about the Ellipse, and what are people missing here?
All right, let me set the record on the Ellipse straight, because I do not want to be known as Mr. Ellipse. When I was working at Patek Philippe, and I still think it's true today, less than 1% of the entire modern production is the Ellipse line. It was very, very difficult to sell. And when I was at Henry Stern, Patek USA, it was my job to sell pieces. So if an Ellipse comes in, as the distributor, you need to have a retailer take the Ellipse and ultimately sell it to an end consumer. It was not easy to do. It was brutal. And there were times where I just wanted to give up, because the Ellipse watches were just sitting in the drawers and not selling. And I dug deep to understand why the Ellipse is interesting historically. All right. Designed in late 1960s. It was the first Patek Philippe that had a true family or line built around it. You see, like, the lighters, the cufflinks, the tie clips, the list goes on. So Patek Philippe really used it as a template to build out their name in the post-Quartz Revolution era. So that was interesting to me. But I do, like many, I looked at it as kind of dated and difficult to sell. So when I started collectability, I was trying to look at, like, what's a watch that you could educate people about, and what could be, like, the next thing? Because everyone, and they still are, talking about the Nautilus. So it's a bit tongue-in-cheek. I was like, all right, I'm gonna have a bunch of hats made up and put it on the lip, right on the forehead, really big. I did, for the first watches, I sold these beautiful keychains, these Ellipse keychains that would come like as a gift with purchase. And I was buying and selling Ellipses, because you could buy them for very reasonable amounts of money. And I have to say, it might have started off as kind of a joke. I truly did fall in love with it. I find that it is one of the few watch designs that is uniquely identifiable as only Patek Philippe. You could take the Nautilus and then play with the Royal Oak. You could take almost any other reference within the line. Even, like, you take a beautiful 570, it could look like, frankly, an IWC from the same time period. But an Ellipse is an Ellipse. It was only Audemars Piguet that was kind of playing with that, and to a bit Cartier too. So I've been running with it ever since, and it's I think the culmination of it is I just got my copy of the Patek magazine.
Okay.
I have the last page of every Paddock magazine now for the last 8 years. I have a collector's guide column, more or less. And you can see there, a 3605 ellipse.
There we go. So beautiful yellow gold blue dial.
Yeah. So I probably just completely ruined the market. I have no ellipses left to sell. There we go. I respect the reference. It is what it is. I think every Paddock collector needs to have one, just because it is part of the historical DNA of the company. But I don't think we're going to see ellipse prices double overnight. That's not going to happen.
All right, good. I'm glad we set the record straight there.
Not until you wear one, Stephen. If you wear one, forget it.
I'm not sure. I might have to give one a go. We'll see what happens there. But thanks so much for doing this. This is really great. I wish we could chat longer. We'll have to, when this is all over, grab a coffee and catch up for real.
Look forward to it. Thanks for your time.
Awesome. Thanks so much, John.